Hi everyone, you're listening to the Vialucci Podcast, uncensored and completely unedited discussions about life and everything in it. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, 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 hello.
Hey there.
I did ask you if you wanted the coffee, didn't you?
You did, I'm fine, I've got my water.
Do you drink coffee?
I only drink tea.
So welcome.
Welcome. Oh, we forget we haven't been talking for a while anyway. Why tea or why not coffee? Like, what was the thing there? Did you give up coffee?
I try coffee now and again.
Yeah.
Because I think, okay, I'm an
adult. Did you used to drink it?
No. But when I was a kid, I was like, when you're older, you'll like coffee because adults like coffee.
Yeah.
It tastes horrible.
Teachers drink it.
You manage to force your way through lager.
Yeah.
So you can do it with coffee. And then I try it now and again. I hate it.
Oh, God.
Really?
I just don't like the taste of it at all. Last time I saw you said you were like drinking 10 cups of coffee a day.
Oh, I used to, yeah. I've gone down to about 2 or 3.
Yeah.
I used to have one at like 10, like 9, 10, 11. I used to go to bed and have a cup of coffee. And then I wonder why I didn't sleep.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even just, when you are asleep, if you're probably not sleeping.
Jittery, yeah.
Because coffee's 12 hours in your system and it's got a half-life of 6. So it's palpable for 6 hours, but it's in your system for 12. So if any having more than 2, you just don't need it. No.
But I mean, now I have cut down my coffee. And literally, I was 40 the other day. Thanks. Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, was you?
Happy birthday.
Hang on. Yeah. I thought you January, February.
It was the end of December.
I think Andrew's the February. Oh, right.
But I have started, literally, as soon as my 40th birthday hit, I have started just fall asleep doing stuff. I fell asleep playing Starfield the other day.
What's that?
I was playing a video game. Oh, yeah. Right. I got a PC, but like literally, because I was like, it's a very boring game. And I was there was like a dot, like 2-3 miles away. And I was like, got to get to that dot and scan it. And I was like, I was so tired. And I was like, just close my eyes for a bit. And like, I just hold forward because it's such a boring game. Just hold forward and like just run at a point.
That's a hell of a compass. Game.
And I closed my eyes and then I fell asleep while playing.
I don't know what's going on.
Stay off the motorway.
It's really bad. It is really bad. Anyway, hi.
Hi.
I was just about to say, what was I going to say? So you just turned 40.
Yeah.
Oh, because Andrew's 39. I think he's 40 this year.
He is, yeah.
Sorry, Andrew's our co-writer. Talking to your lovely friends. So, Soho. You live in Soho. We've just talked about Soho.
Yeah.
So you're one of the few people that actually live in Soho.
Yeah.
How did you end up here?
It's kind of a convoluted story, as these things always are, really. So, my wife...
You just got married last year.
I got married in August last year. Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you. It's still weird saying my wife. Again, this is another,
right, really, yeah,
this is
yeah,
another
yeah,
thing
yeah.
of like yeah. being my an adult.
Wife. How long was she your, what do you call it before wife? Fiance?
About a year and a half.
Not that long.
Something like that. So pretty quick.
Seeing growing up saying
that. Well, yeah, it makes me feel very old when I say my wife. You know? I sometimes say my partner, but she doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Sounds like we work in a law firm together. Yeah. Met at Radio Lincolnshire, BBC Radio Lincolnshire. Oh, yeah. We both used to work in local radio. And then she moved down to London because she got a job there. And then I was like, okay, well, I'm going to follow as well. And then her brother's best mate's parents live in Germany.
Right.
But they've owned this property, this studio flat in Soho since the 90s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so her brother used to live there with his mate for a while, and then they moved out and went up to somewhere else. And then so they were basically looking for someone to kind of look after it for a while and,
right.
and pay mates rates, thanks
yeah,
God.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank God. So it's, you know, it's a studio flat. We're a bit on top of each other, but it's above a theatre as well.
Oh,
so cool. every night at about 10 to 9. I try and time it with the washing up.
Thank you. Yes.
Encore.
and also the it's near the Phoenix Artists Club as well, which is kind of near Tottenham Court Road area.
That's good though. That
that's great. Though.
They got their sound system done last October, something like that. So it's better. It's better for them.
I thought you meant they do the soundproofing.
But well, the guy runs. It's a very nice guy, and they are trying their best. To do it, but like they have live music every night until 2 a.m. Last night was pretty bad, but normally it's not too bad, so they've got it sort of proof. But I've kind of got used to it.
I was gonna say, is it like living next to like the motorway or something where you just kind of like don't notice it after a bit?
Yeah.
God.
And I also didn't want to be one of those, you know, you hear about these people who move next to Wembley Stadium and like, it's bloody loud at this stadium. And it's like, well, it was there before you. You just got to live with it, don't you? You don't move to Soho for a quiet life.
Have you ever had a night where you go, oh my God?
Yeah, early on when it's, so it got
when
redone
you're just not
for
used
like,
to it.
Yeah, when it started, we were like, oh, it's a bit loud. Like, I can hear all the individual lyrics to Single Ladies here. and we were like, oh, well, we thought at the time, oh, well, it must be just because it was Halloween and they do a lot of cabaret and things like that. So, well, maybe it's some big performance. Mm. And then it happened night after night after night.
Then the next
And we are, they're on -1 and we're on -3.
Yeah.
So there are lots of people below us. I think it's partly because of just where the wall is and the sound just goes straight up or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, we got in touch with the guy and he said, oh, yeah, he came around and did a sound test, bless him. So they can just be like,
do you get any discount? Do they say, look, come on?
Yeah, they'll let us in down there and things like that. And actually, the Phoenix Theatre, they've just started doing Stranger Things. So they've been doing a load of construction work on the theatre. And there's this kind of...
How often do you actually use the kindness? Do you go down into the theatre?
Not that often, to be honest. We should do it more. But they've given us free tickets to go see the new Stranger Things at some point, which is nice. Because they were doing a load of construction work. And that was, it was the music of the night. And then the construction guys would rock up at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Did when you, because you worked for BBC World Service.
Yeah.
Is that what you did when you got here?
No. So I started Radio Lincolnshire, just on sort of local radio, things like that. And then I moved down and I moved to Radio 4, and I wrote, the 6 o'clock news. I was one of the writers of the 6 o'clock news on that.
Cool.
So I did that for a few months. Then I moved to the World Service, this part called BBC Minute, which does news bulletins for commercial radio stations around the world. So places like Africa and things like that. We had quite a lot of partner stations there, as we called them. That got closed down. So I got put at risk of redundancy. But then I, because there's been all sorts of cuts going on at BBC, including at the World Service as well, which is sort of separate as well. Yeah. And then I moved to another team. So we've just launched this, the World Service has just launched this new podcast called What in the World, which is like a news podcast for younger people in, outside of Western countries. Mainly. So again,
outside of Western
countries. So we ideally we've been tasked with getting big audiences in India and Nigeria. It's going pretty well and things like that, and we're using some of those partner stations that we had connections with before as well, so that's going quite well. So
how long has that been going now then?
So that started in August or
I was gonna say, it must be
late July, so it's fairly new. It's a sort of version of it gets cut down and broadcast on the World Service as well. Oh. But not a lot of people in this country listen to the World Service, really.
I was going to sleep the other night and I was just turning the phone off. Mm. And it must know the time zone you're in because sleep stuff started to come up.
Mm.
And I don't use that sort of stuff, but it was oh God, what they call the weather forecast, the shipping forecast.
Yeah.
And it was something like... 13 hours of the shipping forecast to help me sleep.
Yeah, they do it.
And you can see that working. There's a lot of things. You go, just it'll go for six.
So it's someone, like someone reading the football results.
It's like
Top
nothing.
Hotspur 2, Blackburn 0.
I have a mate who reads the shipping forecast and he says it's quite difficult sometimes to stay awake when you're reading it. It's quite hypnotic. And like, you know, often you don't know what you kind of got to take the words for it, really. Because I mean, I don't know what it means.
No, it's like frenetic or something.
But it's one of those things that if you were being absolutely ruthless, you'd be like, well, why don't we, should we get rid of this? Should we not do this anymore? But people love it. It's like, it's such a big part of Radio 4.
Is it a real thing?
What
is it, a channel?
It's
or it's like news that comes up?
It was basically for people who were shipping and like to let them know the weather.
How many people have you got to listen?
Well, also now... they're not listening to the radio to get this information. They have instruments on the ships to do this.
I'm sure they have services and satellites and, you know, they probably...
Yeah, but I thought that would go, like, after the 70s, that would have been gone.
But, you know, these
it's
parts
still
of,
there. Somebody's still reading going. It.
So when I moved to, like, parts of, especially the radio part of BBC is really old. Like, so when I moved to Radio 4 for the, what we call it the 1800, the 6 o'clock news on Radio 4, that was the first ever broadcast program on Radio 4.
Right.
So it's been going for 100 years, which is like, you know, when you talk about media...
Weren't they using the World Service? No, I think, I don't know if it's the shipping, but for to get codes across to France and things. Was it? I don't know if it's a world service or radio or the shipping. I thought shipping forecast.
They had the free radio.
They had codes
they?
Going.
Yeah, lots of the free radios and stuff. They used to do stuff like that.
There's this also this urban legend that goes around that the nuclear sub commanders, the UK's nuclear sub commanders, if they don't hear the Today programme start on Radio 4, they know something's gone wrong. They should start launching the missiles. But
quick, guys, don't get delayed. Some dude like stuck in traffic somewhere.
Quick, you don't know.
You don't understand. World. You don't understand. It's really important.
Do you remember? I don't know what it was called. There was something. I don't know if it was a thing, but like on the radio, you could tune to a frequency and it'd be reading numbers.
Yeah, so I actually looked into this. It's a numbers station, and they were really popular in the Cold War.
Oh, yeah, I think it was just called numbers station.
Yeah, and one of the most, I suppose, famous one is Lincolnshire Connection. It's called the Lincolnshire Poacher because it used to play this folk song, which is the Lincolnshire Poacher, and then read out just random numbers.
Yeah,
and it was code basically, and they I think they tracked it down to being broadcast out of Cyprus, which the UK has a military base on, air base on, air station on. It was a way of getting code out and things like that. And getting
Before you turned up, I was talking to Kremlin producer about Turkey. And I looked up Greece, because remember Greece got all that money, you know, all the stuff they were going through. Then they got a load of money and should we be giving it and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, I wonder what they're up to now. So I just Googled it. It was just a load of photographs of... Greek prime minister shaking the hands of Chinese businessmen. I thought that's where it's gone. I bet it's they're taking over the ports.
They've done that in this country as well. They were in the project. I think they're transcoming Dover or something, don't they?
I was surprised. Like British Airways, it's a Kuwait, not Kuwaiti. What's the?
It's the Spanish, isn't it?
It's the UAE. They've just bought 10% of British Airways.
They merged with Iberian, I think, a while ago. Mm.
So. Well, I didn't even realise. I know a lot of the water companies have been bought out by Chinese companies.
A lot of the Chinese sort of investment stuff is part of their, it's called the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a big part of their kind of foreign policy. And it's massive in Africa and other parts of Asia as well. And they basically pump a load of money into sort of big infrastructure projects. But then, there's kind of a price, either monetarily, you know, they kind of got you a bit
especially
over
in Africa, because they're just selling it all off. You've got mini Chinas.
And you can either negotiate with the debt on that. Yeah. And then when it comes to like big votes and things like that, you can be like, well, remember who owns your airport? Yeah. Things like that.
My friend was, I will anyway. He was working on a nuclear reactor. Mm. So he's an engineer and he was doing stuff for the nuclear reactor and stuff. This is fine. He told me, so it should be fine. Yeah. I was thinking, security, he might get in trouble. Yeah. But they said that basically they were doing the thing where these Chinese firms were trying to get into the nuclear market, the domestic power market in this country. And what they found is that they had hacked. They know that they hacked this American company and used their design. They'd literally stolen their design, corporate espionage, because it had a fault in it that this US reactor had that they fixed. So they know, they were like, oh, it had a specific thing like that was wrong with it that they'd later found and didn't build it, I don't think, but they had to fix it.
I was listening to this guy. Oh, you got more.
And they were trying to build this thing in our country and they were like, oh, no, well, that's great, no, the Americans know that this is, you need to change this because the thing the people you stole off it need.
You've been wrong. Like,
it was faulty to begin with.
There was a guy, don't laugh, it was this fellow that was supposed to work for the UFO things.
Oh, yeah.
Not directly, but part of the thing. And he seemed credible. We had the whole background.
Timestamp anyway. UFOs, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Hashtag.
It's a common thing.
Comes up.
Yeah.
But he said, I walked into the room, and actually quite emotionally intelligent, he said, they put me into this thing, and I went further down, blah, blah, blah. And he said, they showed me, it was just on a plinth. It was like an alien arm. And he just said, it would be under more security. So I think they're using this as a way to test my reaction. So I purposefully just went, okay. I think they were expecting to be unemotionally, immature. And go, my God. I just thought it wouldn't be there like that if it was that. But he said, that's something. In fact, that's what that Bob Lazar said. He said, before he went to work on the UFO thing, he said they gave me all this paperwork, didn't they, to read. And people ask him about it, and he says, "Well, this I'm not. It's nothing. It's just words on. Don't ask me about it." It because they were talking about where these things come from and religion and blah blah blah, yeah. And why we keep it secret. He said, "But," and he says, "Like I don't want to talk about it because it's just words on." But he said, "But I had a funny feeling they were giving me a script that I would have. So if I said anything to anybody, they would know it came from that script."
Yeah, okay.
Which you go, well, makes sense. That's, they probably would do that.
They do it with a lot of intelligence, I think.
Oh, right.
I once got one of my mates went to, he applied for GCHQ. And as part of that, they obviously have to screen you and things like that and give you clearance and things. And they make you put down the contact details of a couple of your friends so they can check some stuff with you. So he was like, "Oh, can I put you down?" I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's fine." I get a call. I get a call. Hello, I'm a recruiter from GCHQ. Your friend has applied for this job. Can we just run a few things with you? And I was like, "Oh, yeah, sure, no problem." And they're like, "Okay, does he watch any hardcore pornography that you know of?"
Oh,
and I was a bit like, "Well, not that I know of. And like, has he got a gambling problem?
We don't together. Well, you know, I don't know what Ellie gets up to when I leave.
You don't want to be like, not that I know of. Because it makes it sound like, well, he's doing it. So I was a bit like, I don't know
your friend. I don't mean to make aspersions, but there might be a chance that he is. Yeah. I don't know.
I wonder if that's a test for your credibility. Because if you just say no, are you sure? I don't think he's telling us the truth.
I think it's partly that if it's become so obvious that his mates know, then he'll be blackmailed by it and things like that.
It's a blackmail thing.
Porn, though. Yeah. I mean,
no, but if you're looking at something weird.
Yeah,
illegal.
Oh, Christ. Might have been the first question. What did he say?
They ask if you're, if you're basically, because I had a friend did this for another friend, and they said, do you think he's sort of secretly gay?
Oh, yeah.
Is he hiding that?
Having an affair.
Having affairs, cross-dressing or something in the private, looking at nasty stuff online, weird legal stuff, gambling. Secret drug problem, anything secret that someone could get at you, basically, with, you know what I mean?
But what you're left with as the final candidate would have to be just a sterile. I mean, you sort of want a creative mind, but what are you left with if you just weed everything off?
It's a shame we don't do this for politicians, isn't it?
Well, I wonder in the future, now that internet's there for people from birth, like you'll always, even if you're over 40, you had some secrecy at some point. You can't map everything.
I think with politicians, they'll be like, "Wait, you don't have a gambling problem? He isn't into weird porn."
Yeah.
But
how could you
be?
Because you've got to pretend to be perfect. But if you've now got a full life of internet history and everything else, there's always going to be things you can pick. Because nobody's going to be, you wouldn't have somebody that sterile that would be, because you can be a president now and you don't know everything about them. But if you know everything about them, because you've got a £1 million worth of investigators that can go and check everything, your family's right back, everyone's going to have something. Nobody's going to, because you're not born going, "I want to be prime, I better keep myself in check."
Well, and
unless you're Boris Johnson, then you just...
And then you have the strange, they're often forced to do, they found out they did some drugs when they were at university. The papers find out.
And then they have to do these things of like,
Bill Clinton, I did not inhale sort of thing. Yeah. Boris Johnson said I tried cocaine once, but I sneezed and didn't really count and things like that. So it's, I think as we all kind of... we've all got embarrassing Facebook pictures that we probably wish not in the public domain. So there probably might be a bit of an amnesty and be like, "Look, guys, this is mutually assured destruction. If we go down this lane, let's just keep it above the belt."
There should be a purge day. I think very, very soon in the future, 20 years time, I think when it gets even more, when there's more and more information, we should just go, "You know what? We'll maybe have a reset. Maybe Facebook goes delete and then we just all start again. Why not?"
Well, I suppose though, if you're going to check somebody from birth because you've got their internet history, then they've got yours. So it's sort of like, I know I am, but what about you? I saw a Schwarzenegger in in his bodybuilding thing, very famous, pumping iron. At the end, he's smoking a spliff. Bearing in mind, it's like the late 60s. So he's smoking a spliff after a party with cake, right?
And it's like 60s.
Yeah,
it's like 70s exactly. Weed. It's like ditch weed, man. It's
when he was sort of like getting very popular, people would bring up, "Oh, you smoked weed once." And this is, before his thing. Then this documentary came out, like the 30 years of pumping iron. I thought, that's strange, because he's tried to sort of distance himself from bodybuilders and all that. And at the end, he's going, blah, blah, blah. In the trailer, he says, "Oh, and you want to know if I smoked weed, didn't you?" And I thought, I thought you assumed you did.
No, you definitely did. I saw you.
He goes, "I did smoke it." but I didn't inhale. And I thought, oh, he's going to run for government. That's what this documentary is for. He's answering questions that people that he knows going to come out. Mm. And he's put this out, this thing that he didn't want to be part of anymore, bodybuilding. And he's done this documentary. And he said that, which is a horrendous lie. Anyway,
well, he always denied it. He denied it forever, like straight after that documentary.
Because he knew he was going to run. Second he said it, I thought, he's going to run for government. Because this was before the... Yeah. Okay. And then in his book, he said, no, yeah, I did smoke it and I didn't inhale, obviously. I thought, oh, no, because now you're...
It's legal in California now as well.
But the thing is, you've got no integrity. You can't go, yeah, wasn't lying, and then I was, and now I'm not again. But you're just admitting to being a fucking.
But he was running as a conservative type person,
Republican,
yeah, Republican in the 80s, 90s, and he was sort of running those circles. So it was a different time, yeah. And like stuff like, I mean, both sides now seem to be fine with legalization. So
no, it was just the line. Just come on, don't embarrass.
Especially
yourself.
When. I've seen, you can watch him do it. I literally watched him do it.
It was the 60s, after party with cake, and you're pretending to smoke a fake split.
Down off all the steroids that he
Well, that's the other elephant in the room, isn't
it? That's the more harmful bit. Let's discuss the steroids.
But to know that you're lying, and this is clearly, but you have to say the words. But to who are you saying? Nobody believes you. Mm. And then to, but in his book, to just not ignore it, but to come out and say, yeah, I did, by the way, this. And you go, yeah, but why are you humiliating yourself like this? Nothing's changed. Funny enough, if you want to know about like what's wrong with American politics, read his book. I think Total Recall is called.
Good name.
Yeah, funny enough. Yeah. And because he is no BS. He came in married to a Democrat as a Republican. Everything's about business, and it is it's not Trump business. It's ground up property, millionaire property developer before bodybuilding, before acting, things like that. Business school when he was like could barely speak English. So his whole thing is utility, get things done, do them. Everything has to be useful. So he goes into politics with that, and he just meets everyone. He says, I don't care about the thing. I just want to sort things out. Let's get America going. I don't even want temporary stuff. Let's do things long term. Mm. Let's do massive building infrastructure that I'm not going to be around for. Let's actually do things that work. And he just hit this brick wall. And he's trying to bend over backwards to help people. And they're just bullshitting and infighting between, yeah, but you're a thing. We're not doing it for them. You go, but it's not them. It's me. Mm. No, but we're not going to do that because then you'll get the thing to be able to say you're doing the thing. And he said, it was just a brick wall of, oh, you can't, it's not about will. The whole system is we're not doing stuff for you because it will look good for you. And he tries to get around it with like, his worth ethic, just tried everything. He said nothing. It's just, this is the way it is.
Rory Stewart's new book is horrendous. On similar things, on like the struggles of getting things actually done in politics and the sort of things that get, you know, the roadblocks that get in the way and things like that. It's worth just reading.
Has it always been, because I feel it's become a bit more partisan and we're sort of going down that American model of, you know, even something that is kind of universally kind of a positive, like you just think, oh no, this side's doing it, so I have to oppose it. And I don't always feel, I mean, I'm not that old, but like, I don't always feel that it was like that in this country. I do feel that sometimes that there were sort of cross-party things and there were times when the sides came together and stuff just to get things done. Having said that, I suppose with all this, I suppose we can come together when it's something negative. When there's bombs to be to be let loose.
I think it's to do with amounts of money. You can sort of track it. Like America's got the biggest levels of corruption in terms of wealth because there's so much money involved. We're still quite parochial in terms of our money. Like our leaders still live in houses that you can sort of walk past. They're not out in gated communities with like 50 men. I mean, like Nancy, what's her name?
Pelosi.
Yeah, she's worth like 200 million. Do you know what I mean? That's another level. That sort of, what happens is you end up sort of being so removed that you don't actually see real people because you live in this mansion.
It's starting to be like that in this country. I mean, how much is Rishi Sunak worth?
But this is what I mean. I think it's to do with how much you're actually interacting with normal society. If it gets to the point where you're worth hundreds of millions, you're now not living in Islington. Now you're living and you're in a limo and you're flying around from place to place. And now you don't really know there's a real world. Now you are just making deals.
What kind of works, I think, sort of for our system that kind of keeps them a bit more grounded is that you know, you are a constituency MP,
as well. Yeah.
Mm. So because where I live, I'm in Camden technically. Keir Starmer's my MP, so if I want, I could be like, can you sort my bins out, please, Keir? Yeah. And like, you know, if you're a US senator or something like that, you don't really, I don't think, deal with those lower level things as much, and you're not as tuned into where your perhaps area is.
I just think the more money that gets involved, the more removed you are from sites. You don't, and it will find its way, and it'll be like the privatisation of NHS. It will creep in bit by bit by bit, or deals, you know, massive deals with other countries that people are, I think it will erode even our little.
The election how they campaign in America is like, it costs loads of money and they throw millions and millions of dollars at TV adverts. Whereas in this country, you get, this is an election message from the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah, and you have to be careful who's getting how much airtime.
Yeah. They measure it.
They traced back.
And you have to do, being Veeb, so you have to, to have rebuttals and stuff, don't you?
Yeah. During election periods, we have to record how often, so on from the radio side, when we're doing just news bulletins, we have to make a note of how many
the amount of
clips from each party being played. Not in the same bulletin, because otherwise you wouldn't get past the first story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, it has to be balanced throughout the day or the week or things like that. And at the end, they tot it up to see, you know, you should. And that isn't saying that every fringe party gets as much as one of the bigger parties. Yeah. They weight it against last year, the election results last time. And that's trying to sort of keep it sort of proportional, really.
I know there are restrictions as well on the newspaper front pages on days of elections.
Yeah.
You have to be very careful about what they...
Yeah. We're on the actual day before the results come in, you can only say, you can't speculate at all as to like, oh, it looks like Labour have a lead or the Conservatives have a lead. You're under strict like rules as to, you can be like, the polls are open. That's it, basically.
Yes.
That's why you have every
goes to the polls.
Yeah. Every time you see on the BBC News website, dogs at polling stations, that is partly because there's not much else you're allowed to do.
Right, yeah.
You know, it becomes very strict about that.
There was I read this thing about 7 or 8 years ago, and they looked at how much it costs to run. Mm. Like, you have to get money in, which is bribery, you know, they're not doing it for no reason. And the first billion, it cost $1 billion, was, I think, George Bush, the dad.
Yeah. Oh.
And then it went up to sort of $3 billion for the son. And then it went, I think it was before Obama, was $7 billion.
Really?
And because
I think Trump got it for quite. Trump did a good deal. He got a good deal.
They traced
the deal guy.
The five presidents, it was all who raised the most money became the president. So he said, really? It's a fundraising. That's all it is. It's fundraising. Whoever, so don't even worry about the president. Just see who gets most money and say, you're the president. But that,
I saw a thing from this congressman, and he was saying that, basically, you have, in order to get reelected, you have to earn whatever X amount of money, but you have to earn 100,000 a week, say 50,000 a week. So he said, literally, most of these days, sat there calling up donors, big donors, and asking for money and hustling for money. And said, that's mostly what you do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I don't think they have a limit on how much money they're allowed to raise, whereas MPs do have donation limits in this country.
Yeah.
I read an article just a few weeks ago, and it listed out all the big donors, and the donor list is getting smaller and smaller because the amounts are getting bigger and bigger within it. And now it was like the top five, and just think of this statement. The top five had donated the same amount of money to both parties.
Well, you've got to hedge your bets.
Pharma company. But you go, but that's not even hiding. Why is that not on the front page? Why? It's bribery, but without using the word bribery. We're literally giving both your money, so you both are in debt to us.
Lobbying, they would.
Yeah, I mean, but it's just... It's almost like this schizophrenia is going. Like, so you know it's corrupt. You know they literally. You can show you the numbers to show we're paying off both sides. It's not we ideologically agree with both sides. So you know what that is. But yeah, that's what we do. You go. That's not what are you talking about? That's corruption.
And once you're in as a US president, you basically get 2 years to kind of do your agenda, and then the back 2 years are kind of campaigning for re-election
again.
And because you know to compete you need a lot of money, and actually in the battleground states it costs more money to get advertising on or you know, the TV networks know it's worth more, so they can charge more and things
like
that. It's
funny. Then you put in like the midterms, which I know they're not trying to gain money, but you go, it's just a constant cycle.
It's designed to be like that. So it's constant.
I would always watch the progressive ones that would come, like Kamala Harris and all these people that would come up. And the main politics basically keeps everybody out. But every now and again, they just get somebody to just make them feel fresh, to get somebody else in. But they would always do the rounds on all the progressive networks, talking. They'd wear a jumper, a T-shirt, and the kids and the students, and, oh, we love this person in America. And then as soon as they get to that point where the people in power can then see, who's this head popping up that everybody likes? Let's get them. The door just closes behind them and all their progressive values go out the window. Then the power suit comes on and you just go, and I would see one after the other. The only one that's stuck with it is Bernie Sanders. He's been doing it since the 80s.
He's been consistent.
Fighting for gay rights in the 80s when he was the only one and people were laughing at him.
Like Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, whatever you say, you know, whatever your opinions about the man, he has been consistent on his views. Yeah. I'll give him that. Like, you know what I mean? To have some quibbles with some of his politics and stuff, but like, he has been he's been the only one who's been consistent. And he got in power, and then he still was pretty consistent. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. And like, and even to the detriment of, going back, but being head, you know, the opposition, even to the detriment of becoming prime minister. I mean, he could have toned it down.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of what, like, bless him, Keir Starmer, bless him.
So Keir Starmer
is Mr. What was it, Captain Snoozefest Crasharooney?
But I mean, you know, from his point of view, they are close to 50% in the polls now. Mm. So, do you want to mess it up? It's this close?
Hell no! Like hell like, no! Because
from his point of view, obviously.
Yeah. But I think he's going to be better because I just don't see how he could be any worse. But I don't think it's going to be a magic wand, unfortunately.
Well, nothing is. You always get behind something and it will never be the thing you want it to be. It's just, there's always somebody new. It's like we don't understand that the system is the problem. And it's always, well, this person's this. They're the first one at this. You know, whether it's the first black president or the first female. Margaret Thatcher, the first woman. It's the woman because it's the men. Get the women. It's a BBC thing, actually. And they spoke to I think it was a secretary. I don't know if she had a book out. It was about 8 years ago. And she said, so she was talking about the woman behind the woman. She was saying she used to cry a lot. Like she didn't, you know, she was, but she said, you know,
I cry all the time for us prime minister. Yeah. I'm not going to hold back.
It was about the thing of like, oh, politics is ruined. Here's a new thing to believe in. It's a woman. And then, oh, the woman. And then she came and she said, she had like the Women's Institute and obviously like all that behind her. This is the first woman. That was a big part of the thing. And she said, she was in charge of hiring. And she said to me, do not hire any women. So she said, basically the door closed behind me because to her, it was a sign of weakness. So even her with like the Women's Institute and everything behind them, once you're in, it's about pretense of what it makes me look like. And she just assumed that I'm in a man's world. I need to be strong. Do not hire any. She said to me, do not hire any women. She said, the door closed behind me as a secretary. I said, so even then, like, that's how you got in, that little extra of the women thing. And that, even that didn't matter. It's just like, no, I'm in power and it's all, I don't care. It's like, don't hire any women.
I mean, we've had two female prime ministers and a lettuce. So, I mean, it's
three. Theresa May. Oh, Lel. Yeah.
Lel. There you go. I still look back at
Washington
those days.
At that point.
Yeah. I still look back at those days. Great times, you know.
Brief.
Do you know the thing with politics? No matter what you say, it doesn't matter. It's like we could just yarn forever and it just doesn't matter.
Well,
yelling into the void.
You've got to sort of...
No, but it does. And that's
I know, you've got to... No. Your whole life and everyone else's life has to be crippled to the point just to get it to nudge in the right direction. But
this is the thing, is that this is kind of what it's what they
yeah I know what are, you're gonna say
want
yeah,
you to think yeah. is to make you feel powerless and you know and to check out that's people quite happy with that to not be engaged it is very difficult and it's annoying
but you're
it's annoying for you and it annoys everyone around me having to listen to me bitch and moan about and just get really angry at things that I have no control over and my general frustration and impotence at the world But I think it is important. It is important to stay informed, and it is important to keep on just shouting at those clouds. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, but it's at a certain point you go, well, how many generations have we been shouting and just nothing? It just, not only just nothing, it doesn't even do the courtesy of getting a bit better. It's goes backward. Well, so it's rolling towards you down.
If you look at,
I think,
you know,
Johnson and Trump.
If you were doing this 100 years ago.
If you had any
ago,
hope.
If we were doing this 100 years ago, when Radio 4 Bulletin started, you would, you know, I don't think women could have a bank account then.
Yeah, no.
You know,
yeah.
It's incremental.
I grab at things and go, well, but then it's like with Trump and Boris, it just pushes you back again. You go, oh, come on, we can't go backwards. So you go, well, you're getting this and you're getting this. You go, but yeah, but there's all these.
Yeah, we got Facebook and Reebok, okay? Things are much better than they were. Yeah, come on.
It's a little thing. I remember there was a friend of mine, his dad came over from Cuba. And how long ago is this? Oh God, I've lost sense of time. But anyway, and I was driving through central London, and I was saying about he wanted to use the toilet, but it was in central London, and it's like that sort of out the mouths of babes, because he doesn't know about the Western world, really, not a lot. He barely spoke English, and he was looking for somewhere to stop a toilet. I said, I can't stop here. Oh, I actually can't stop. It's not about no, because there might be cameras. You know, it's ring roads and central. And he was like, he said, this is like Cuba. And I suddenly realised, oh yeah, I literally can't stop the car. Like, it's not just, I don't know the area. And there's lines all over the place. There's signs everywhere. There's proper cameras everywhere. I don't know where I can, but I definitely can't stop it. I know that. And I'd said it to him a few times. And when he said that, I thought, oh right, yeah, I've got used to this. Like, I can't just stop the car. You're literally in a rat race. I can't. I remember seeing an old Carry On film, and it was, I think it was the camping one, where Sid James, he's in his car, and he pulls up, and he's right by Buckingham Palace, and he just gets out. There's no lines, and he goes into a shop. And I thought, oh wow,
get some smokes. And yeah, comes out.
But Buckingham Palace is just on the corner. He gets out. I thought, there's no line. There's nothing. Just a clear road. I thought, he just got out, ran in the shop. And I thought, and then that fella said that, and I thought, yeah, this is like a. It's almost like a dystopian future thing. I've arrived here in a rat race. I literally cannot stop here. I can't stop the car or I will be fined. And I thought, oh God, that is a... It just stuck with me. That he was like laughing at it, not going, oh, this is terrible. He said, it's like Cuba, you can't stop the car. I was like, no, I can't stop. Oh, right, yeah, I can't stop. Oh, let's get off of this anyway. I hope it helped in our own little way. I hope this is a bit of enlightenment. So what's going on with you at the BBC at the moment then? So you've got the podcast stuff.
Yeah, so podcast is up and going well. And
how often do you say it comes out?
Every day.
Oh,
every
wow.
Day. Every day. Oh. Yeah, so...
Are you specifically doing certain countries or you're doing the things for all the countries?
We're doing sort of the big global stories.
But I mean, not different producers that focus on different countries?
No, we kind of just look at what's sort of going on and things like that. And we try and do stuff that is a little bit... off the main news agenda, just because.
What sticks in your mind of the last things that have been going on that was a bit?
So we did an episode on China's Belt and Road Initiative, which was, I'm not sure if anyone else is interested in this sort of stuff as I am, but like, you know, we sort of did like, you know, it was 10 years or so since the Belt and Road Initiative began, maybe even longer, 15, something like that. We looked at some of the big successes and some of the big failures. Some of the big failures are like, so there was a big airport in Indonesia, I believe, and it's one of the least used airports in the world. No one goes in it. We had someone from the bureau go, and he was just like, it was just empty. No one on the roads up to it, no one at things and things like that. There was also another a railway in Kenya that just stops in the middle of nowhere because the money ran out halfway through and things like that. But at the other side, you know, they've built huge infrastructure projects for African countries that wouldn't have got them otherwise.
And they'll do it quick.
And it's also, you know, we can point the finger at China and say, oh, they've got nefarious reasons for doing this. But like Western countries have done this as well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Build these things and like the IMF will help you do this, but it comes at a cost. And there's then some, you know, you kind of, it's partly, you just got to think what you get out of it and leverage and things like that. And often it is leverage rather than the money. So that was an interesting one. We're looking at, I don't know if we'll actually end up doing it next week, but we want to do something on obviously what's happening in the Red Sea at the moment, but also, so sort of shipping, international shipping. So there's basically four ways to get to ship something from the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere. So can you name them all?
Suez.
Yeah.
Panama.
Correct.
Swindon.
Yeah. Amazon. The Strait of Magellan, which is kind of a bottom of sort of Argentina.
Oh, okay. So
it's very 1800s. Yeah. Like, it's, you know.
Cape of Good Hope.
Correct. Yeah, that's the other one.
Sail around the Horn.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other one. Go around the bottom of Africa. So the Red Sea is obviously having this big crisis at the moment with the Houthi rebels and things like that. But the Suez Canal is also having a problem of its own because it's a freshwater canal rather than seawater. So it's not at sea level. So there's locks and things like that. And it's basically because of climate change, it's drying up. And so the levels have shrunk, the water levels have shrunk, and now they can't get as many ships through.
Right.
So this is kind of happening at the same time as the Red Sea stuff as well. So it's this kind of perfect storm for international shipping.
I was thinking how fragile, unfortunately, all these systems are now. We have, you know, 24-hour supply things and whatnot. You know, so there's some you know, industries operate with 24 hours stock or whatever, you know. But I mean, I was remembering when that ship got jammed in the Suez Canal.
The Ever Given.
For a couple of days. It was for a few days. And like the knock-on effect for that was felt for months.
And
like globally.
As well.
Yeah.
We were in, I think I was at Radio Linkage at the time there, and there was a garden center that was like, you can't get anything because the ships are so big, they don't actually put that many through a day. I think through Panama Canal, they only put something like 38 through a day max. Mm. They've now had to drop it to like 28 because of the dropping water levels. But you think that I would have guessed it would have been thousands, but because they're just so massive, you don't need to do it as much and things like that.
Everything's I was thinking about like talking about mutual assured destruction. Mm. There is a weird thing where every country is so corrupt, the thing that keeps everything sort of safe is that they all want money and everybody's connected to everyone. I mean, when you get to the point where China owes American money and America owes China money and we owe China money and they owe us, and you go, so really, nobody...
Exactly. Those sort of interconnections make it.
It's globalization.
In theory, more sustainable.
I've never. Could you sort of rationalize if a kid just come up to you and said, "Can I just ask you a question?" Yeah. You know how everyone owes everybody money? Yet what? How does that? I don't understand.
Oh, that's good.
What would be the answer?
That is a good thing.
How does that work? You owe me money and I owe you money. Right. How did that happen? Who owed who the first?
Well, there was, I remember a while ago, there was a stat going on, wasn't there, that sort of, I don't know, that Chinese money or Chinese, that they were underwriting X amount of American debt or something, it's 2 or 3 or 4 or 5%, something stupid. And they, you know, lots of people say, oh, this is, you know, it's terrible. This is a national security issue. But also, it's like, well, yes, but also no, because that means actually China's invested in the American economy to do well as well.
There's that old expression, you know, if you owe the bank 100 quid, you've got a problem. Yeah, if you owe the bank 100 million quid, the bank has a problem.
Yeah. So I've always had that in the back of my mind as a sort of like when people talk like the end of the world, I think everyone's pretty greedy. Nobody wants to lose money. I mean, like, there's two things actually that's what somebody was saying about when everyone's saying, oh, Russia, like Putin, he might. Just he realizes he's going to get done. He's just going to drop the nuke and all that. So he's got nothing to lose and all that. And with Trump as well. And here's a BBC journalist again, and he said, "It's a little thing, but you should make note." He said, "When and this is when everyone was saying he might the nuke. What happens and all that?" I thought he said, "When like the pandemic hit, he ran into a little cave and stayed there." And he said, "What that tells you is he's desperate to live." But don't forget that. He's not like a religious fundamentalist. He's a billionaire with a lot of money. He doesn't want to die. He knows when he's dead, he's dead. He doesn't believe in it. So the fact that him and Trump ran away when there was like any problem, like, hide me away from people, that tells you self-preservation's at the top of his list. So he's not going to start blowing things up to get him blown up. He just told you that that's a person, I want to stay alive no matter what.
That might have been Steve Rosenberg.
I can't remember. It was at the time, but I thought, that's that. Might be now.
Yeah, he's the BBC's Russia editor.
Yeah, it rings a bell.
The BBC used to have quite a big Russia bureau, but it's basically just Steve and his producers now. Like, poor guy, like, you know, but he's a tremendous journalist. He's really good. We spoke to him on one of the podcast.
I was going to say, I did some years ago, yonks ago, I did some work experience with BBC Berkshire.
Oh, yeah.
Good times had by all. Yeah. It's really good fun. And And at their local office, I think they have moved since, but they used to have the foreign listening station there. Mm. So what they did is they had all these people there who would monitor, you know, Russian broadcast, Chinese, whatever, Indian, yeah, all across the world. They'd have people who spoke those languages and they'd just be watching the news feeds from everywhere, just making notes and looking to see what was happening. And they had these, every time I saw, they had these two Russian gentlemen. Mm. And honest to God, it was like they were dressed like Trotsky and Lenin.
Nice.
They had like a beret and a chief and a brown coat. Yeah. And they were smoking these sort of black cigars.
And constantly going, in thought. Yeah, constantly
and they were having deep conversations. Yeah. You know,
about communism.
Like, well, I don't know, but in the smoking, they were the only one in the smoking area. It was two dudes. And it was just like... Yeah. They look like it's like, are you from the past? Like,
are you being filmed?
Yeah.
Journalists who came
in. Into a scene?
And then they just disappeared into this like black room, this dark room with with like all these monitors in. And it was,
great. Well, we still have, it's called BBC Monitoring, the department. And we still got, it's sort of partly, partly commercial arm of the BBC as well. They sell the sort of monitoring stuff to other media companies to see this is what's going on in these countries and things like that.
Yeah. I recently listened to a podcast, and it was a ex-KGB guy, but he's been in America for like 30, 40 years, and he was talking about like when he was there, the fall, and they start with his background, how did he get involved in all that, and he's just a very smart person, a bit of an eccentric, and it popped up on the radar at the time. He said he didn't have to do anything. Everybody's under being looked at then, so they just notice you, and then I got pulled in, and do you want to do it? Which is sort of like you have to, because your house relies on it and whatnot. Anyway, and he talks about it, and they send him to America, and he's saying like what their things were at the time, what to do. He said America still didn't really know much. It was sort of cliched stuff. They didn't have any long-term information about how it all worked. And he said they didn't. So what happened is we went through like how it all worked, and you basically every day you go to like four or five of the same places every day, and there'll be marks on a wall or that just tells you a message.
Right.
Yeah. So he said every day I have to go past this wall. No matter what's happening, I have to wait to go to the shop.
Spycraft stuff.
Yeah. And there'll be like a dot on the wall and a little dot in the corner. And
if the curtains will be open or something.
Something like that. So there's all that. Yeah. And he said, but what the Americans did, so what he said, when like he said I was very well looked after, and that went on for like 10 years, and I was passing the messages from. He said, but their theory that he said, I didn't know, he said, I thought America knew more than they did. I thought they were always on to us. He said, but when it came, the walls came down and things, you found out they didn't know anything, because I was like the first generation of people that came out of the KGB. Mm. But he said, they don't tell you what's happening, like things are going really bad in the Soviet Union. They don't tell you any of this. Yeah. You just do your job. You don't ask questions. Questions can lead to you getting in trouble. Why are you asking that? You shouldn't be asking questions. Why are you asking the questions?
Especially in intelligence work. Like you don't ask questions. You get told. Yeah,
but they basically said to him, you go to America, and this is what the Americans didn't realize he was teaching them. He said, you don't come there as a spy. You go there to get a job.
Mm.
And you just get a job, and you meet people when you go to the clubs, and they leave you alone. And he said, just have a life, have a story built there. You have a backstory that never comes from Russia. He said, they'll send you to France first to like learn French, because then you're adding another dimension of truth to it. Mm. If you just make up a lie, but you're from Russia, but if you go, no, I was actually from France, but then I was born in Russia, and yes, here's my story from France, it becomes harder to check.
Yeah.
So you go to there first, and then you come to...
You have layers, they say you're supposed to have like layers of lies.
Yeah.
And the legend.
But they wanted you to have little real lives before, so every layer was hardly a bit... But he said, so I went to France, and then I came to America, and then he said, I got a job, and they said, they leave you alone, and all it is every week or every month I'd go to a certain place, buy a tree, and there'd be a cup or whatever, and they'd have money and whatever I needed, and I'd leave a message and blah, blah, blah. He said, but they weren't telling me anything. He said, they think like you're up to all no good. He said, no, what you're doing, you're actually integrating into the society over a decade. And he said, so he met a girlfriend, had a kid with her. He said, I knew I was building up to get into a school, get into a thing, have a job, and then they will open up a company for me that I will say I've run.
Right.
But now you've got a story. You can't just go in there as a multimillionaire and say, oh, who's this fella? Because I've been living here for 10 years. I worked here. He said, they have you do menial jobs. So he said, I was in Manhattan doing the messaging. on the bike.
Oh, right.
It's a horrible, terrible job. But he did for like 6-7 years just so I could learn everything. He said, you never went there with anything. He said, they wanted you to actually know what it's like to live there. What do people think every day? How do people's tones speak? They're not teaching you anything. You have to actually go and be part of it. So you have to actually go and live there. And he said, but they're leaving you alone. And you just figure things out. And when you go, you speak to them, you're telling them, oh, well, I did this thing. Okay, go with that. Then another 4 months. What are you doing now? Go with that. Try that. Okay, that. But you're actually living a life. It's just that you've got this person you have to keep sort of going back to. But they're giving you money. But the idea was, yeah, get to a certain point and then we're going to open up a business, but now it looks like, oh yeah, you've started a business, and then we'll shell money through it.
We did an episode of the podcast on Vladimir Putin and sort of personal facts about him, and you know, what's it, you know, what do we really know about this guy. And he started off in the KGB, and there's some people, so he was in East Germany for, we know he was in East Germany for a while, yeah. And like his sort of job was basically talking to Russian academics who would at some point get a chance to go on foreign trips, and basically kind of recruiting them and sort of saying, you know, keep your eye out for this and tell us what happens when you're there and that sort of thing. But there's some people that swear that they saw him in New Zealand, in Auckland, working as a shoe salesman in the early 90s.
There you go, yeah.
And that was, you know, part of his sort of KGB
training. No, yeah, just throw you off. It was funny, this guy said, he said, when you, like, everything was going through...
This is my
hold on, you've got to plug your headphones back in. Can you see it?
There we go. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so he said, they weren't telling me about what was going wrong. All I was seeing about the Soviet Union was through the papers. They're not telling me anything. He said, the first I knew about it, he said, for the first time in sort of 20 years, he said, I went to this place and there was
nothing,
no money
on the wall.
And nothing in the tin. And he said, that's not right. Collapsed.
Yeah.
And then he said, right, I'm in a bit of a pickle here.
Yes, I'm completely on my own.
He had a wife in Russia. He said at the end, oh, because I had a wife. I was like, hang on, what? You had a wife? But she sort of knew this is the way the world worked. And if I have to go, I go, and this is it. But he said, obviously didn't tell her I had a kid. He said, but I'd fallen in love with this woman. And he said, and I did. Yeah. He said, so what do I do? He said, I have to leave her now with this kid that I love to go back to just a wife where I know I'll be all right. They should look after me though, because it's still what you're looked up as, no matter.
Yeah.
He said, or I stay here, but now I'm in a bit of trouble. Like, what do I do? Because now I've got to, it might come out.
Well,
like,
also it's a bit dodge going back, possibly, because they might.
Yeah,
just
I was
think,
surprised he didn't make more of that,
because they might just think, well,
yeah, we don't need
you. We don't need you, and it's a bit of an embarrassment. And you've been sort of doing shady stuff in America. Yeah. Better if you just kind of disappear.
Well, like, maybe I am that businessman. Yes. Just pretending to be all this time.
Well, maybe I'm just a courier, like Manhattan. Yeah, all right, that's my thing. Yeah,
yeah. Maybe you just think, am I schizophrenic? Like,
yeah, I imagine all this.
Yeah, yeah. He said, no, I love this woman. I've got a kid. He said, I just walked into the police station and said, look, it's all collapsed. This is my story. This is what I'm doing. And he said, they actually couldn't get enough of him. They were very pleased that he came forward because they didn't know anything. He said, I was surprised what they didn't know. I thought they'd always be under, because it's the United States of America.
So what, he sort of claimed asylum then, did he? Or?
Yeah, I don't know what he claimed, but he just went to And he said, he worked for them. And he just said, I'll tell you everything. Tell you how they train people, what we do. And he said, they didn't know anything. He said, they couldn't believe it. And now he's out of it. And he said, but now he lives in America and the whole thing. I just thought, that's a funny life that is. Think of living like that. Did you ever, BBC again.
BBC.
This isn't that long ago. It was a late night.
I'm not a spy.
It was Radio 4. Yeah.
I'm not a spy is exactly
I'm always
what a spy
about
would
the
say.
BBC. It's on my LinkedIn profile. Like, my education came from the BBC. It was the, I don't know if it was based on a book. No, it might be in a documentary about the Muppets in Russia.
I was not expecting that.
I thought it was going to be a John le Carré.
I was thinking, okay, Tinker Tailor.
It's when they had the Muppets was so popular over here, in America, sorry.
Yeah.
And it's, they want to go into the Russian market.
Okay, yeah.
And I was listening to it late at night driving, and I had to stop. I realized that it was late at night, so it's probably earlier on in the day at some point. So it was a podcast. I listened to it because it was so interesting. Because now I'd read the autobiography of Jim Henson anyway, so I understood what the Muppets actually stood for before the Muppets, because there was puppetry and then the Muppets.
Muppetry.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole thing was completely different. Like every country 20 years after still hadn't caught up to what the Muppets, how they, you had to be trained for years to be able to operate the Muppets in very specific ways. They were designed to be for adults and children, and the way they moved and things was very specific. So they want to move into the Russian market, and it was just because obviously they come in with American values. Like she mentions once, right, that they're in a meeting with all the people. And now bear in mind that when you, you read about the Muppets, it's not just puppetry. It's a very specific type of puppetry, which you don't really realise till you listen to the book. Again, you have to be trained for years and people don't can't make it because it's a very specific type of thing. Anyway, so they go into the Russian market and it's sort of like what you'd think puppetry was. You know, it just... Punch and Judy-ish, but more advanced. Yeah, yeah. They had their version of the Muppets.
What's that, Woody?
Oh, hello. Yeah. And she said there was one bit.
Were they going to do a Russian Kermit?
Yeah, they're taking it to the same puppets.
Das for Daniel.
Only because they'd obviously, but they'd asked for it because they'd seen how, at the time in the 80s, like how big it had become. It was a TV thing. Like,
yeah,
it
yeah.
It wasn't just for kids.
It's a weird thing because it hasn't really been on this in England. I know that there's new Disney shows every now and then, yeah. But like, it's still like a thing that people know about. And yeah. It's still like kids know about. It still has a cultural relevance.
After Jim Henson died, it's when all the money men moved in and it slowly starts to erode the ethos of what he kept forward. Because don't forget, they moved to London. I mean, Boreham Wood, I think it was. Like, that was their
base.
They
did them for a bit.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, yeah, they moved. Anyway, so it was just before they started doing the films. What were the films called with them?
Muppet Treasure films. Island and
yeah. What there was this was
Muppets it? Take Manhattan.
Yeah. No. What was no
Christmas Carol.
Dark Crystal, not the Muppet film.
The Netflix one. No, the original one. The original.
No, well, and they did a lot.
Animatronics. Yeah, they were the first.
They
ones.
Did some of the animatronics in Star Wars and stuff as well.
Like, yeah, like that's like, what I mean. It was a skilled thing.
Yeah, they were like Industrial Light Magic. Yeah, sort of.
So that's why they came here. Oh, was Star Wars filmed here?
Some of it,
I think, Pinewood.
Anyway, so they came here. So anyway, so Russia said, like, this thing, let's have it in America. We invite over there, and she was explaining to them what we are, like what it stands for. And she was saying, look, we've had some ideas. This is what we should do. And she said, we didn't realize what we were walking into. She said, because basically, she said, look, there's one bit where the woman said, well, what we have is we have like a lot of the puppets will be with like kids and they have like lemonade stalls and like it's about selling and buying. And I said, everyone's like, you can't have them. He said, why? I said, because
capitalism.
No, worse. She said, no, in Russia, all those market stalls are controlled by the mafia. Oh. You can't just set up a stall and say it's for kids selling. She said, that people won't understand what you're talking about.
Get their fingers broken.
Yeah, she said, no, you don't understand that. They're all run by the mafia. But she said it was just little things like that. You go, oh, right. And then you've got the Russian thing anyway. She said, but it's not like you're walking into deal with the KGB. It's a company. It's a business, a media business. And they're sort of loosely run by the thing, some of them, and some of them aren't. But basically, you're working for a company. You don't know nothing about the Russian thing. And they want to do it. And the company were behind them, and they were quite liberal. Three people were assassinated getting this out because they basically didn't want it made in the end. They said, you've got to change
Animal,
this.
Animal, Miss Piggy.
No, yeah, but they said, look, the people behind
Gonzo.
It wanted
Gonzo.
To
Gonzo's
do it.
Gonzo's asking
Gonzo.
For it.
Gonzo's
gone. But
they were part of the first, like, they were the liberal company, and they said, look, we want the Muppet, but the Russians were like, you can't. But they weren't fully on. It wasn't like the Soviet Union. They weren't just... But yeah, the guy that was like the head of it got blown up in his car, and she said, "That's
the head of the Russian Muppets."
No, that was part the American Muppets through it. That was the media company. I think it was a woman. She got blown up in a car, and then somebody else got killed. And she said, "Then we all had to come together and say, listen, what are we going to do? We can't have this." And I think a third person got killed, and they just pulled the plug.
It's not like the Panama Papers. It's just like,
oh yeah,
but it's like, hey, you know these wacky, cool, goofy characters we have for kids, and they're just no, it's fun. It's just fun. Like
well, there was pressure.
We're just going to bring it to Russia, and they're like, right, okay, and they start to say up kill lists for people.
Check this out.
Well, it was the first generation that was sort of after Soviet Union, it was still there, but the Soviet Union had fallen. But they were trying. It was that first set of companies that were trying.
Those early 90s. It was like,
and they were quite passionate people of like the way things had been. And the head was saying, "No, we want it to be like this." And the government was saying, "No, you can't. You've got to change this." But they're saying, "No, it's not the Muppets." But then when we got killed, but she was out speaking about it on the news, that the main person, and she said, "Like, we went into shock. She's been blown. Like, they've actually killed her, but they won't do it again." Because this is so shocking, and then somebody else got killed, and she said, then they had to have a meeting and say, listen, you can't, this isn't...
So what right. doing yeah. the Muppets.
But yeah, it was all about...
in the motherland, this year.
It was all about... But that's what I mean, I was listening to it, and then you go, oh, Jesus Christ, there's like a lot going on here. You can still get it online now, but it's
fascinating
to watch.
That is the magic. So was that, were you listening to Radio 4 and it came on?
Yeah, it was
That Radio is the 4. Magic of Radio 4. You never, ever know what's going to come on, and it's always something weird.
You can. I'm telling you now, 3 or 4 in the morning, that I just turn it on just in case, and 50% of the time, I go... Oh, right. And I have to go back and listen to the whole thing. There was one about a singer. I can't remember her name. Never heard of her. And but she she ran away from home when she was 15, taught herself to sing. She's got this amazing voice. I turned it on and there was a song. I thought, God, that's like a unique voice. And then I listened and she was like homeless. She left her home when she came. She was abused by the parents and all this sort of thing. And she's a bit of an earth child sort of singer. But she had this one hit that became very big in America. And then I went and listened to her and I listened to a load of her songs and her story. And I thought, I just flicked it on just to listen. The Muppet, I just flicked it on. I thought, the Muppets in Russia. Cause and then she was saying about the assassinate. And I thought, oh, we'll have to go back and listen to that again. I have to be careful turning on the BBC because I haven't got enough time to listen to everything.
Like that is one of the perks. I'm going to say that's one of the perks I think of, not just Radio 4, but I think of broadcast radio and television is that, and this is how, you know, with streaming and everything online stuff, I think we are losing a bit of that. And I think the way that newspapers were, I used to buy a newspaper and I used to just sort of read most of it, flick through bits, read headlines, read sections that I wouldn't necessarily. I read it differently because if I'm reading stuff online, I wouldn't click on half of these things and I wouldn't digest this. And there's lots of stuff that I watch. I just you're randomly flicking through and you catch a film or an interesting documentary or a bit on the radio, and it's really interesting. And I wouldn't necessarily click on that and seek it out and listen to it myself.
Yeah,
but. Just having just being exposed to it sort of almost at random, almost, you know, by happenstance. I think I had a bit more of a broader sense and broader, more interest in learning more than I do now. Because
like you say, it's kind of algorithmic, isn't it? And algorithms are based on what we know you're interested in. And you might be like, well, I don't know. I'm not interested in something else. So you know, you sort of silo yourself, and you find it whenever you're on TikTok or things like that. You like one video of, I don't know, someone, a cute dog or something like that, and then it's like dogs forever. Same with the Amazon thing, you know, you go on Amazon and you buy a fridge, and the Amazon is like, do you want to buy another fridge? And you're like, no, I have a fridge. And you'll get emails.
About some water and eggs for the
fridge. Well, we know you love fridges. Yeah. So
this
guy is more
all
fridges.
About fridges. Yeah. He's obsessed with fridges. Just give him more fridge content. Yeah.
But I can't imagine there's many more places that are as diverse as BBC. Because I basically, I have about 4 apps for BBC stations and they cover everything. They throw different things at me, different lengths. I mean, do you remember, I think when we did our first show here, when I was telling you about the woman that was in the cave for like 2 years, remember? And you started laughing and she started to be able to see and she wanted to stay down there.
This was the woman who...
Brazil or something.
And she'd done it just to see how long she could stay.
Yeah, and then she ended up... they pulled her up and she said, I thought it was like a few months, and he said, no, it was time to come out.
Ages,
And she said, emotions started to come out in me. She said, I fell in love. She said, but the emotion of love...
With the cave?
No. Oh. They're just the emotion,
okay.
But with nothing to put it on. Like, I just a weird quirk of the brain. There was nothing that is psychological.
Like sensory deprivation kind of thing.
Or solitary confinement.
Said, when they said to like you've got to come out, she thought, I thought I was imagining things.
Yeah.
Because you hadn't got used to it. They had a rope thing. But she said, she wanted to go back because, you know, you climatized or whatever it was. But yeah, that was from that was one of the BBCs. But to me, the BBC is, it's like the last line of defense for professionals. I know people, a friend of mine lives in Wisconsin, quite a political thing. He said, I just listen to the BBC for the political news. He said, I sort of trust it. in purpose. So it's, so you know, that's,
I'm not going to sit here and pretend it is perfect.
No, but no, nothing's perfect.
It is the most trusted media brand.
And for how long it's been around, to be able to poke at a few things and go, well, but how much have they done?
Well, this
that's a fairly good record.
Yeah, this is the thing as well. I'm told and I read a lot that, oh, well, they have bunch of lefties and left wing bias and this and that and that. And I honestly,
and the opposite.
I have had
right wing ghouls. And
yes, fascists. Yeah, yeah. I had someone in a picket line go on and on. Lovely older chap, but he was very intent on that they're all fascists and kind of plotting with the government. I was like, well, I don't think so necessarily, and I think they do good work. So maybe you're doing something right if everyone thinks you're being biased. But I do think those people say that. I think, well, you obviously don't watch it, because I do think that it is as bad as neutral-ish as it tries to be. Balanced.
Yeah.
Neutral, sorry. I said balanced and fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is always the intention, and it doesn't always work out. And there's been, cock-ups and fuck-ups and... It is always cock up over conspiracy. I can tell you that for now. It is always because, something the size of the BBC, it's like this size of the NHS. It's like a cruise ship. You spin the wheel, nothing happens. Yeah. It takes a long time to turn things around and change things. And there's going to be,
any criticism of the BBC, because you go, well, how long has it been around? How much content has it put out? How many people have worked for it? Now try and match that to any other company in any industry and tell me any
large institution is going to have slight issue. I mean, look at the post office.
One thing that was annoying people in sort of my office this week is a lot of people are saying, oh, it takes an, why does it take a drama for an ITV drama? Why aren't journalists doing enough? Why does it take an ITV drama to get all this done? It's like, this ITV drama is based off journalism.
The best of the end.
So Computer Weekly got it first, and BBC have done a very good podcast on it a couple of years ago, and Private Eye follow it up all the time. And you don't get the dramas without the journalism first. Yeah. And also that's kind of drama's job to kind of, to elevate stuff and smooth the edges off to make it more narratively appealing and things like that. Yeah. Often when you do with journalism and stuff, it doesn't follow that narrative that is sort of satisfying. Sometimes it just ends and you're like,
well, you're just reporting.
And it's definitely journalists and the BBC's job to get people interested in stories and the news. Mm. And I think actually a lot of media is for a long time, everyone assumed people like the news and liking the news is a moral good, when actually I think we need to remake the case of why people should watch the news, because it's boring and depressing for a lot of the time. It's boring and depressing. And actually, that's partly because how you pick which stories you pick, how you sort of, treat them and things like that. And you don't want to depress people because they'll just switch it off. Yeah. Especially now, you mentioned earlier, you would get exposed to the news. You'd be watching, I'd watch The Simpsons on Channel 4 and then the news would come on afterwards. Mm. And I'd be like, oh God, bloody news is on. But then, you only watch 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but you're getting, maybe it hooks you in, maybe you learn something, you hear something. Now you can actually quite easily not look at the news at all.
Yeah.
You lose that kind of accidentally encounter.
I preferred when there's just like a news at 10 and then the news at 5, because you had a bit of time to figure out what had happened at things. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Not just quick. Like, I mean, the America's again the worst one. We think the Simpsons, when they parodied the weather guy, we think there's a huge storm. It's about to, we're a few minutes away from what we think a million people are going to die. You go, well, has it happened yet? Has it actually happened? I like the fact that there's been time to go, well, what has happened? Don't tell me how many people, because it will go from 15,000 people have died and then it would drop down. You have to tell me that minute.
I've had to do the classic stand in the freezing cold weather and being well, the police are saying no one should be out at the moment. I've had to do that before. Oh, that is a classic. And that is partly because if you don't show people it, they won't believe you. They'll think, oh, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
And then when you see some poor, weather person freezing their ass off, you're like, oh, or
in the wind.
You got to show people this stuff.
You kind of have to go, you kind of grab someone. It's like a Clockwork Orange. You sort of had to force their eyes and be there with little pipettes, like watering.
And because, with the not to go bang on about the BBC constantly, but because it is not obviously it's funded by the license fee. It's not fully commercial operation like the US and things like that. There is room for these things that are quite niche or like, you know, aren't going to be make loads of money or even get a huge audience. So I was, when I worked at Radio Linkager, they let me do a documentary on why there are so many sex shops on the A1. With my partner, so we got to
okay. So why are there so many?
So basically, they all started out as little chefs. And this one guy.
So this is a story about this, so many sex shops being on a major road in England.
Yeah,
so I feel we're getting into an onion
down
here.
If you drive down the A1, you see them. There's loads of them. Like, and you're like, why are there so many?
So where's the A1? What are we passing?
So you're going up like, you know,
it's not Hertfordshire.
So you go all the way up to like Lincolnshire and things like that, and then down sort of, it's a big long sort of A road coming basically north to south. And you can go in a long way up.
So they were little chefs. That's
they were little chefs. And then we managed to, there's a lot of, there's the brand, like a lot of the branded ones were called Pulse and Cocktail.
Again, I wonder where that was going.
And we managed to track down the CEO of Pulse and Cocktail and ask him why are they all built on the A1, and he was like, well, when we set up, they wouldn't let us build them in the town centers, and let us build them in the towns. So, you know, we would get people saying, we get like, you know, council people would say we couldn't do it, people would protest and things like that. This is the only place we can sort of build them. And then I realized that actually they're making loads of money, because you'd get lots of, because I was like, who's going into these things? You know, like, is it lonely truckers? I asked the guy, I was like, is it like lonely truckers or what sort? And he's like, no, it's mainly like couples going on holiday or for a weekend away and things like that. And they want something to spice up. They sold all sorts in there. And I talked to some of the
sweets. Surprising.
Selection.
Selection of humbugs.
I spoke to some of the people who work behind the, you know, just account, just to say, you know, tell us some stories about working here. And they were like, once I got...
Is that what that grey streak in the side of your hair is?
once I had someone come in who said, I don't want to buy anything in the shop, I want to buy your shoes. And I'll give you £1,000 for your shoes. And she was like, I'm not going to sell you my shoes. I'm sorry. Another person said, I am currently wearing a cock cage, which is like a small device that...
To do what?
It's kind of essentially like a chastity belt.
Oh, to keep it in?
Well, to caged up essentially. And he's like, I'm wearing one now. And I want to give you the key, and I'm going to come back in a week and I want to pick it up from you, and I'll give you some money to do it. And she was like, no, I'm sorry. We don't do that.
That is.
I don't want to know.
She said,
I thought it was to keep stuff out.
I was thinking, I'm not going to Google that.
This is something that GCSQ would ask. But like, he said, yeah, no, most people, it's just like couples looking for, you know, something to spice up the weekend, that sort of thing. The most expensive item in there was a full size sex doll. Customizable, you could change its eye color, hair color. £2,000 it cost. But if you wanted to spend £1,000, they'd just give you the legs. So it was, you could buy just
that's your thing,
just the waist down for a grand.
What's happened with sex? I've got to assume they've gone. I've only got Only Fools and Horses blowing them up with the.
Well, no, this was like silicon and things like that, and very.
It wasn't like inflatable.
It was like a. I mean, I don't know how you get it home. I guess you have to put it in the boot and hope you don't get pulled over by the police.
Is it full of metal inside?
Well,
I've only got future robots and like the blow up ones, and I've got nothing in between.
I think we're still at. This isn't going to work via audio, but I think we're still at this phase.
The bicycle.
Yeah, like silicon or plastic. It's still just going to go.
Even then, it's just a balloon.
At the end of the day,
it's a balloon with a face.
I think it's just a lump of plastic.
Yeah, it's sort of softer
it's,
plastic.
I don't know.
I
saw one in the window in a shop in Amsterdam in the red light district, and it stuck with me.
You sure it wasn't a real woman?
No. Well, this real. It was a toy, and it was called and. I apologize.
Don't give the robot's name.
It wasn't a robot, but it was a sex toy. Yeah. And it was called The Fist.
Oh.
Right, yeah.
And it was a rubber forearm.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a few of those in the shops.
This big, very long, and it wasn't a small fist either. It was a big fist.
Not display, but that's not going to...
I don't know. But they used to have all this, and they used to have all these sort of posters of like, the front covers of DVDs and movies.
Yeah. Well,
all these hardcore scenes, but they used to be up just on display. Oh. And I remember, like, I was just walking through there, and like there were loads of kids walking past going to school in their school uniforms, just completely like...
Oh, so you can see it from the street.
It was in the window.
Yeah, in the red light district.
It was in the window.
It's quite,
it's a bit of a tourist spot as well as the red light district. When me and some mates went to Amsterdam, we were like, oh, let's go look at the red light district. And it's just, it's like Disneyland. There's like families there, and like it's really just out in the open and things like that. It's kind of, it's kind of weird.
It was slightly refreshing. That's what I'm saying.
Because it's kind of like, maybe we make too big a deal of this stuff in the UK.
A little bit. We can be a little prudish, you know.
We said in the previous podcast, I was listening to a BBC documentary, and it was about the women that worked in the windows, and they, when somebody went and spoke to them, they said most of the abuse they get is from women.
Oh, really?
Like body shaming them, but like the men are just sort of a bit more, oh yeah, look at her, cool. And the women a bit more bitchy, like. And she said that was the hardest thing, because they were in the windows just shouting like things about your body at you, where men wouldn't do that. A little nod to the BBC there. Well, let's get off the BBC tech. Right, so we 5 minutes, let's end. But
BBC means something very different in the sex shops, by the way.
Yes. I'll tell you later, Bondage. Don't worry. Big, right. Big something.
We've got balloons and bottom. Right, anyway, but what I was going to say?
That's going to be wearing around your head.
I'll forget. Let me forget.
Bouncing
wrestling.
Oh yeah,
wrestling.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we first started the show? Back in how many offices ago? About three offices ago. When we spoke to Patrick Sutty, the pro wrestler. Do you remember we filmed a comedy documentary? Mm. He was. And he, I remember. I went and listened to it recently. It was anyway, somebody was an actor. But when I say wrestling to you, who comes to your head? What ear, what who's your stars?
So my sort of first exposure to it was like, it was something that was talked about at school.
Yeah.
And like, we didn't really have it on like English channels. It would come up now and again, and like people would occasionally get hands on a DVD or a video. You know, the Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Your mate had Sky, basically.
Yeah, if your mate, yeah.
And a VCR.
Like, and they would broadcast at like 2 a.m. as well, so you have to do that. So, yeah.
I remember all those big guys, I think it was ITV late at night. You had like WCW wrestling. Yeah. And I think in the summer, they'd play like the previous WrestleMania.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I couldn't just about remember Saturday mornings, Big Daddy.
Yeah. So that World of Sport on ITV.
Yeah. Just a few months. I could just remember a few things about it. And that seemed like wrestling.
Yeah.
And then I can remember it was one summer, they did like a SummerSlam WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And Hulk Hogan bursts out. 6'8". You know, the blonde hair, mustache. The muscle giant. There's 100,000
skin
people.
Of a hot dog.
There's 100,000 people here. I'm like thinking, what the hell? It's like another planet. And they've got the music and the flags going. And I actually watched you know, a lot of these wrestling things are because the internet popped up, and they're now speaking to older wrestlers when they started, like 70s and 80s.
Loads of them have died.
Yeah.
They?
Yeah. I mean, well, one I listened to just died. Oh. He's a British guy who went to America, slightly lower level, but he was known.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Big Daddy and all that. And he said, basically, everyone remembers Big Daddy, but he said he destroyed the British wrestling because him and his cousin owned the promotion. But it was taken more seriously before he came along.
Yeah.
Because they had storylines and people would follow you around the country.
Well, it was born out of circuses and carnivals, basically.
Yeah. He said, but you had we were long-term wrestlers and people still didn't know back then. He said, Big Daddy come along and it was just, he was playing for the camera on Saturdays. That is it. There's no storyline. He said, so you couldn't have a baddie because he would just, whether's a baddie, would just get beaten up that weekend. I need a new baddie.
Yeah.
He said, then they would do, there's no storyline, but here's a bad person that's just come, he's just started, and he wants to fight him that next week, and he'll beat him straight away. He goes, but there's no battle here. And then he said, it got to the point, he was so greedy for the fame, he said he would have like the two baddies, which is the only two baddies, and he'd beat them both at the same time.
Yeah.
He could be, all you're doing is playing for the next Saturday thing. You're destroying the industry of people. I want to follow him up north to see, because they're going to battle up there. He's just beating everybody. But health was so bad. He said,
look at the state.
His match, he said, you watch his matches. He said, they don't go on for more than a minute. He said, it's basically the people run at him. He he hits them with the belly.
Yeah.
They fall down.
They had the same.
They run again, hits them with the belly, fall down. He said it got to the point in the end, like they had to introduce tag team matches.
So he could just because stand on the side.
He'd have the younger person. And that guy just goes in to get beaten up. And then he tags, and then in he comes again, belly. He said he got to the point where he wouldn't even bend down to pin them. So he would just put his back foot up on again. Them.
Yeah.
So it was like a 30-second match.
Well, the same thing happened to Andre the Giant, who was obviously sort of a comparable massive star in the US. And he actually had giantism.
Yeah.
So he was never going to live long anyway, really, especially back then. But by the end, he could, just couldn't really move around.
Yeah, just lay on the ropes and people bounce off him and things. But apparently at least he'd done stuff.
Yeah, he used to go to Japan a lot, and apparently the travel was horrendous for him because he was so massive. He couldn't go, and he'd have to take these long-haul flights to Japan. And also, once he got to Japan, the hotels are very, you know, they're not very big.
It's not necessarily a country made for a giant man.
No, who was like, you know, 7 foot or something like that.
So, well, he'd have to go to the bathroom in the bath, a toilet in the bath. He would put...
At least that's what he told
him.
I have to. It's a thing. Yeah, it's a medical condition. No, but
I can't remember, there was another wrestler who said, and he said, I once saw, he said, he just, what he would do is he laid paper out on the bed and just crap on the paper. And then just because he couldn't use it. He can't use the toilets.
But you've got to watch. I have to do this in a medical dish and you have to watch. Yeah. And I have to wear Batman cape one day.
No, but basically his back, he said he was always drunk. He was always drunk. He didn't
see
drunk.
Well, there's legendary stories about how much he could drink.
Yeah, like, but the
drink they said, 30 beers.
This guy said, he said, look, he's in pain all the time.
Yeah.
So he's basically just always drunk. He just don't know it. But it's just taking the pain away all the time. But yes, he said it wasn't funny. He said people would really abuse him.
Mm.
Like they would call him horrible names everywhere he went. He said, I used to want to thump people on his bath and he would just ignore it. He said, it didn't matter what country either. Yeah. They'd call him like freak man. He said, but you'd go into a bar in America and then people would be throwing things at him from trying to get him to do something. He said, but it was constant. And he said, he's always in pain. He said, since I was a kid, he said, he drinks, he just takes the pain away. But he said, I saw him take it. He just put paper down and just shit on him, just fold up. Because you cannot use those toilets. It's impossible. Mm-hmm.
I think wrestling is, to tie this off, I think wrestling is a very American wrestling anyway. It's very interesting. And I think it says a lot about American culture, like all sports, you know, say about their domestic culture. Cricket says a lot about colonialism, colonial values and stuff. American football says a lot about the commercialization and, you know, sports and, you know, the money and big money and everything. But like with wrestling, I think, especially American wrestling, I think it shows because you think, because I sort of looked at it when I got a bit older. I was like, well, it's fake. This is fake. This is so stupid. It's obviously fake. It's just silly, melodramatic storylines. It's already, how can these people just sit there and cheer on when this is just ridiculous? It's a pantomime. Mm-hmm. But then you talk to the people who the big fans, and they're like, "Yeah, of course it's fake. Yeah. I know it's fake. What do you mean? I'm not dumb."
Yeah,
and you're like, "Well, how can you?" And they go, "Because it's fun.
It is fun.
And it's like a Marvel film. You don't say, well, how can the Hulk?' You go, what are you talking about? It's a Marvel film."
And very much so. It does have that almost. I swear, it has that sort of comic book.
Yeah,
That sort of. Oh yeah, you're 60s, 70s.
Giants flying around. Yeah. That is
they're like superheroes. Yeah, they're built like, you know, they don't look like normal people. They're built like.
No. And they're kind of morality plays.
Yes, very much so.
It's very Shakespearean. if you want to wax lyrical about it.
But it's like a sort of Stan Lee kind of episode of Captain America versus whoever, you know, like having best fights.
Because there was a wrestler once, he was in England doing something, I was doing it in a nightclub, and he came with this cage fighter guy that I knew, and he turned up. And you know there's like English big and then there's American big and you don't really realize that you can feel the weight of the person walking past you.
Yeah.
I think you must have been, I knew someone who worked there at 6'4" and he was towering over.
Right.
And this guy was 6'6", 6'7", but the dimensions were different.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, he's actually got a shadow. Like there's a shadow. I'm standing in his shadow. You forget. And he's not like the giant.
He's like blocking out the sun.
Yeah. But he was wide and thick. And I thought, I look like his kid.
I've been to a few, you know, wrestling shows and things like that and seen some, you know, you see some of the smaller guys on TV and they come out and they're the biggest fucking person I've ever seen. And then they look tiny compared to the big guys.
One of these clubs I worked at, we'll end on this club. Anyway, we had to leave because people were getting shot and things like that. And they usually blame it on somebody so you can get rid of them and then say, look, it wasn't the club, it was these people.
Right.
So we got kicked off. Anyway, and I went back and there was a doorman there. And he was touching 7 foot he was wearing a shirt and I could see his neck muscles in the shirt, like he was that. And I'd just never seen anything outside of like a static property. I just, and he was American. I thought they'd got him on there because whenever you take over a door, there's always going to be backlash from the people that couldn't get in before that you've built up relationships with, that you allow them in. And now you're, it's all, you've got a wall of people that have been coming in here doing their thing. Oh. So they have to put all the best, the big guys on the door for the first few months. And so he was on there. Was there? And I just when we come towards us, your brain has to adjust slightly. He's like, that's not real. It's further away. And it comes to you, go,
you go, how far, how far away is he? Yeah. And then he just goes, oh my God.
But it's like a disability to be that big, surely, because you can't go through life being that big. Like, but, anyway, yeah, so that's that. But yeah, so it was funny, the wrestling thing. But I've always appreciated it. You grow up and then you realise what it is and how hard it is. And the word fake has stuck to it, which it shouldn't have. Because it's real. It's just theatre.
It's a pantomime. It's a pantomime.
Yeah. Who's your favourite wrestler?
My favourite wrestler, probably all time, Shawn Michaels.
Oh, really?
Yeah, HBK.
If you had to watch, Heartbreak if you Kid. Could put any two people together well, in you history had
that,
of wrestling.
I think, you always had that with, Shawn Michaels faced like The Undertaker in a couple of WrestleMania matches, and I think those were
the because I can just remember the it was on a VCR that somebody, the Turkish family I knew, I couldn't tell you about them, but they had satellite and he saved me the tape, and I was probably, they just got me a year before I would have realized it's complete nonsense.
Yeah.
And The Undertaker comes out and you're like, what the hell is that?
And he's 7 foot.
What is going on? It's just everything about it. Like, he's had Paul Bearer with him. And you're looking at him going, I don't know what this is. Is he dead? I don't isn't it great you could go back to there where it's all the first time of seeing these things and not knowing anything.
Everyone goes, boo, and he goes, your town smells like manure. Yeah, the classic, you bunch of hayseeds.
Who was that guy? What's his name? That Jim Carrey played. Oh, the comedian.
And
he did the wrestling, but he'd only...
Andy
Kaufman. That's quite...
yeah, that was it.
Because you could obviously, he was like, there was filming at the time, you could see him. It's not just the Jim Carrey thing. And when he goes to do his local spots at around various towns, he's going to these hick towns and telling them how to wash.
He says about the soap.
So that you can use the soap. You've got to add water. Don't forget the water.
Okay, boom. Yeah, just throwing chairs. But
he's got to come back at like Oscar Wilde. He's got to have a resurgence of like people realizing what he did. Like, he was a very strange guy. But the wrestling, he would say like, I could beat any. He'd only wrestle women.
Yeah, he was the women's world champion.
And there's a thing that went on with him and the other wrestler. We got slapped in one. What was it called?
Jerry the King Lawler.
Yeah. Ooh. And again, the other realism, because on the show, like he said, I want you to really smack me one. He said, really fucking dumb.
Well, I remember.
He said, this is Jerry Lawler saying about it. He told me, I want you to hit me and I want you to put some sting on it. It's just a really, so of course he didn't know what was happening when it was the thing, what's his name? Leno.
One of the.
Carson.
Letterman. I think it was Letterman.
Carson?
I thought Johnny it was David Carson. Letterman.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, he didn't know what was going on, which added to the realism of like people still going, is this real?
Well, there's only so much of it you can fake, really. Yeah. So I remember, you know, you find out it's staged and things like that, and you think, oh, well, it must be fake blood, things like that. Yeah. But actually, when they, you know, when they've decided they want to bleed in the match, they hide razor blades in their wrist things and then cut the top of their forehead because, apparently, you don't have to do a very deep cut there to bleed a lot because it's quite thin skin.
I remember the Macho Man talking about it. He said they put it on the inside of their lip.
Yeah.
And he said, I'd forget. And like a week later, I got it sellotaped and I'd forget that it was in there. And I'd be eating and things because you've got a bit of tape on it. And it's just, there's bits where that just you can feel it's not touching. You go, a bloody razor blade inside your mouth. And he said every time you'd nick yourself, but you'd get it too deep.
Yeah. Oof, God.
Right, well, on the blood-soaked entertainment, back to politics. Yes. So what are you up to now? What's going on? Do you have a heading of what you're trying to do at the BBC? Throw a hook out
I do
there.
A bit of presenting on the podcast. I'd probably like to do a little bit more of that. And
come on.
I'd like to do some... I'd like to do... I did do some kind of... documentary stuff. I would quite like to go back to. It's called long form audio in the BBC.
Yeah,
sort of like
long form. Yeah,
I really enjoy those. So
I listen to all the Outlook stuff.
But,
it's great.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm really enjoying the podcast at the moment. Cool. So it's want to see it grow and you get it off the ground, really.
And did your missus still work for the...
Yes, she's actually flown off to Davos today. I mean, she's outdoing me by miles. So she's with the business unit. So she's gone to Davos for the conference. So she's there this week.
Cool. So what's her role? What's a journalist? Or?
Yeah, so she's actually the transport producer for the BBC. So she works with a correspondent who covers transport and things like that. But that falls under what was the BBC's business unit, which is now called Money and Work, because this is the BBC and this is what we do. She's gone out with Faisal Islam, the economic editor.
So where do you go to work every day? Is it in Portland Place?
Yeah, Broadcasting House in...
by the old Falun Gong. I keep saying that.
Yes, yeah. The Chinese embassy.
I keep meaning to Google that. I did have a look briefly when I was sitting and I thought,
we'll have a chat later. It's the whole thing.
Yeah, it's opposite the Chinese embassy.
New Broadcasting House, it's called, and it's at the end of near Oxford Circus. So,
I bet I was going to make a joke about the Falun Gong, but I don't know anything. It might not be humorous. Well, are they on our side or are they bad?
I'm not sure.
It's a grey area.
They're weirdly connected to Shenmue, is it? That stage show? I can't remember.
SHEIS.
They've got connections to that, and they're basically very anti communist, and that made them very pro Donald Trump in the US, and they funded this thing called the Epic Times, but it's spelled Epoch, so
E-P-O-C-H,
which was a big disinformation vector on Facebook pro Donald Trump, because he was perceived as being very anti-Chinese, so they're this kind of the Chinese would say they're a cult, basically. But they would say, and they maintain that, like, some of their members have been essentially abducted by the Chinese government, persecuted, and had their organs harvested.
Yeah.
And where the truth in that lies, I'm not sure, but, like, it's weird.
I think I'll leave the light of payment humour.
Yes, it's...
Right. Because I always see them out there at night, because I come out late at night, and they're always there with the little candles. No opinion on the Falun Gong, whatever that is, or whatever.
Drawing a blank there.
Is the Falun Gong a person? Or was it a
Let's leave it.
Well, so what are you up to today? What are you going?
Well, I'm going to do some yoga with my mates in Falun Gong, and then I might go to the cinema.
Anything off the top of your head? What you might
say? I want to go. I didn't get to see Napoleon. It's still playing at some places.
Oh, I watched it recently.
Was it any good?
I liked it because the actress is called something Kirby. It popped up straight away, and I thought, that's Charles Kirby there. Yeah. A little reference.
But I wouldn't mind seeing it on the big screen because the spectacle, battles and everything. It probably a lot better than watching it
It's odd. It's a good film and it's odd. But as I always said to you and AJ, I said, I didn't know what was real and what wasn't. That's why I was starting to distrust films. I am watching it thinking I don't know anything.
Yeah.
But I'm going, right, is that real? Did that happen? I think it loosely did, and they weave in a love story and
combine some things. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And enjoy your film.
I will do. Okay. Cheers.
Especially have a good time. Exploding horse bit. Here's your story. Let's begin. The world is fine. Come on, dive in. The future's here. It's right before you. Could be alive. You could be alive.